I'm afraid I'm going to do a little male bashing here, but you're all used to it, so you can take it. You know, God did create new human life before in different ways. He made the first man, the first male, out of mud, right? And he made the first female out of the rib of a rational creature. Now, this explains a lot when you think about it, right? And one male, after one of my talks, came up to me and said, yes, certainly it explains a lot. He said, it explains why I'm treated like dirt a lot. So anyway, our church, our society has a great disregard for the value of human life. We do not understand what a great gift it is to participate in this act with God. God has chosen spouses as his vehicle for bringing forth new human life, and new human life is precisely what he wants in this universe. As a matter of fact, every one of us should be putting forward most of our efforts, all of our efforts, to getting ourselves to heaven and helping others. That's our job, right? And spouses play a major role in this by bringing forth that new human life that all of us are meant to be forming. It's an amazing task that God has given us. It's not something to be dallied with. It's not something that should happen as an accident. Having sex, having babies as an accident is not in God's plan. Having babies is meant to be within the loving act of spouses because God wants the parents to love the children in the same way in which he loves all of us, which means in a committed and unconditional way. God loves us in a committed and unconditional way, and he wants parents that are committed to each other for a lifetime relationship who are going to love these children in an unconditional way. And our society can't begin to see that. Babies are just options, burdens, environmental hazards, something to be taken down to the abortion clinic and terminated. Now, along with our disregard for the value of human life is an enormous disregard for fertility. Right? We don't have any high estimation of fertility. Contraceptives are manifestly related to an hostility to fertility. Think about the word contraception. It means against the beginning of a new life. And what makes a new life possible is fertility. So we talk about the pill. It's one of my favorite words, the pill. I mean, when do you take a pill? You take a pill when you're sick, right? But pregnancy is not a disease, and fertility is not a disease. Fertility is a healthy condition in an adult person. It's those who are infertile who need assistance in becoming fertile. They are the ones who need the medication. Fertility is a perfectly healthy condition. I don't like to challenge doctors in this way. Anyone who wants to straighten me out afterwards, you're welcome to have a shot at it. But when I think of a 15-year-old boy who goes in a doctor's office and says, doctor, you know, I want to get the girls. I want the girls. He says, and the way to get the girls is to have big muscles. So would you please give me some steroids? And any doctor worth his salt will say, son, get out of here. Join the wrestling team. Lift weights. Do push-ups. I'm not going to give you steroids. They're bad for you. They could ruin you. I'm not giving you steroids. But a 15-year-old girl trots into a doctor's office and says, doctor, I want to have sexual intercourse with my boyfriend or boyfriends. And the doctor says, I'll write you a prescription. And it's a whole lot worse for her health, psychologically and physically in the long run, to be launched on the kind of lifestyle that a contraceptive launches her on than that steroid is for the young man. And I want to know, what's going on here? Why has our culture told us that this makes sense? Why has our culture told us that this is a sensible thing for a doctor to do? Okay? Now, there's a wonderful book out by Dr. Ellen Grant called The Bitter Pill. And she was very much in on distributing contraceptives in the 60s in London. But she saw woman after woman coming in with different pathologies that she found were pill-related. High blood pressure, blood clots, cysts in the breast, all sorts of things, lumps in the breast. So she said, I'm not going to prescribe these anymore. She looked into this, and she discovered that when they were first testing for the pill, they were trying to find a male contraceptive pill and a female contraceptive pill. And in the first study group of males, they found that there was some slight shrinkage in the testicles of one male. Right? So they stopped all testing of a male contraceptive pill. You might notice that there is no such thing. Right? In the first study group of females, three females died. Right? And they just readjusted the dosage. Now, I don't know what that tells you, but it tells me there's something sinister going on here. Right? Women are still dying from the pill. If you look at the insert in any set of pills, and you can get this from a pharmacist if you can't find it elsewhere, it says such things as the pill will cause blood clots, high blood pressure, heart disease, some greater increase of some kinds of cancer, infertility. Now, these are very small percentages where this happens, but there are some 16 million women in the United States on the pill, 16 million. And even a very small percentage is still a very large number of women. Not to mention the day-by-day side effects. These always fascinate me. Most women, in fact, 50% of women who start on the pill stop within the first year because of unpleasant side effects. So these side effects are really largely those of the 16 million who continue. So you can imagine how bad they must be for the 50% who stop. But what are they? Most women complain of increased irritability, okay, increased propensity to depression, weight gain, and a reduced libido. Now, I don't know about the rest of you women, but I've been looking for a pill that will make me more irritable, more depressed, help me gain weight, and reduce my libido so I can have sex. Right? And I'm sure all the men here would like the woman he's dealing with to be more irritable, more depressed, to gain weight more easily, and to have a reduced libido. Don't you? Now, why does the pill do this to a woman? Why does it do this to a woman? Well, the fact is that the pill makes a woman's body think it's pregnant. It gives its hormones that are there in the first couple months of pregnancy. And women in the first couple months of pregnancy get irritable, depressed, gain weight, and have a reduced libido. And women are in this condition when they're on the pill for week after week, month after month, year after year. It's an astonishing thing. Now, I haven't really told you the worst reality about the pill, which is really that it's an abortifacient. I've been talking about it as though it were a contraceptive. But it also works as an abortifacient, at least it says so, in the insert that's in the pill. It says in the insert that's in the pill that it works in three different ways. One is it stops ovulation. And again, that's clear enough. If it makes your body think it's pregnant, it will not ovulate because when you're pregnant, you can't get pregnant. When you're pregnant, you don't ovulate because you have a new baby growing inside of you and there's no reason to ovulate. Or if that doesn't work, if there happens to be breakthrough ovulation and no woman knows when that's happening in her body, I mean, women have the most complex hormonal system. As you know, if you've ever looked at a chart of the female hormonal system, there's three major ones as far as their reproductive system is concerned. And they go up and down like peaks and valleys, and they crisscross, right? And I showed this to one of my friends, and she said, you know, I've never felt like the same person from day by day, and now I see that I'm not. I'm dealing with a whole new chemical system every day. And as you women know, you wake up in the morning and say, gee, am I going to be the sweetest person in the world today, or am I going to be the meanest person in the world today? How do I know? Let me see how I feel after my coffee. And it mostly has to do with your hormones. You know, male hormonal system, it's just wonderful. You know how much fluctuation there is in that? There's two of them. Straight line, all month long. Okay? This guy seems steady day by day, same guy yesterday, today, and tomorrow. And you don't know who you are yesterday, day, and tomorrow. There's explanations for that. They're called hormones. Right? But a woman doesn't know month by month how her hormones are acting, whether she's not ovulating when she's on the pill, or if there's breakthrough ovulation, and the pill can, what it's called, change the viscosity of the mucus, right? There's a certain mucus that helps the sperm get to the egg and a certain mucus that prohibits the sperm from getting to the egg, and it will change the mucus. Or it will prevent the nidification of the fertilized ovum, right? That means fertilized ovum, new little human being working down the fallopian tube, trying to implant itself in its mother's uterine wall, nest, nidate, right? But it prohibits that, and the woman sloughs off the new fertilized ovum. And a woman doesn't know how this is working in her system. Norplant works this way, the IUD works this way, Depo-Provera works this way. And think of the other forms of contraception, true contraceptives, the barrier methods. It's a wonderful word. I want to make love to you, but I've got to get my barrier in place. Sounds a bit like making war, not love, right? I got to get a good spermicide. Spermicide means kill the sperm. I want to make love to you, but I'm going to kill any sperm that come my way. Something hostile in that act. But I claim it's hostile primarily to a female's fertility. Because, you know, it's males who can have sex and not get pregnant. So what the pill does and contraceptives do is make a female like a creature that can have sex and not get pregnant. But that's not what we are. And it's not a great burden and a great defect to be a person who can have sex and get pregnant. That happens to be a great gift. But we treat it as though it were a great deficit. Something that needs medication, devices, etc. So for now, I've given you two reasons why the church teaches that contraception is wrong. One is that it locks God out of his procreative act. The other is that it treats a natural gift of life and fertility as if these were not gifts, as if they were burdens and defects. right? The third thing is John Paul II's observation. He claims that contraception violates not only the procreative meaning of the sexual act, but also the unitive meaning of the sexual act. It prevents not only babies, but it also prevents bondings. I'll give you another Adam and Eve joke just to lighten you up a bit here. And this is Adam and God in the garden. And they're having a little conversation. And Adam says to God, he says, God, he said, I'd like to thank you for this creature, Eve, you made for me. He said, she's just wonderful. He says, thank you a lot. And God says, you're welcome, Adam. Adam says, but God, I do have a complaint. God says, all right, Adam, what's your complaint? He says, well, he said, why'd you have to make her so beautiful? He said, you know, she's so beautiful that I think about her all the time. I get distracted. I can't get my work done. He said, you didn't have to make her so beautiful. Why'd you make her so beautiful? And God says, well, Adam, I not only wanted you to have a helpmate, he said, I wanted you to have someone to love, and you would be happy. Adam says, oh, wow, gee, hadn't thought of it. Thank you, God. That's very thoughtful. He said, but I do have another complaint. God says, all right, Adam, what's your second complaint? And Adam says, well, God, he said, why'd you have to make her so dumb? He said, you know, she's just so dumb, she doesn't make any sense, she's irrational, you talk to her, I don't know what she's up to, one day I'm the greatest guy in the universe, the next time I'm the worst guy in the universe. He said, why'd you have to make her so dumb? And God says, well, Adam, I not only wanted you to love her, I wanted her to love you. Sorry, guys. But, you know, it cuts both ways. That one cuts both ways, right? But isn't that the point? That God made male and female to love each other, to have babies, and to bond. And we have to think about how violating this procreative meaning of the sexual act is also violating the bonding meaning of the sexual act. First of all, in a simple way, John Paul II has very profound and beautiful things to say about this, and I can only give you the briefest of descriptions of this. But he says that the sexual act is meant to be an act of total self-giving. You want to give everything you've got to this person. And when you're withholding your fertility, you're withholding something that belongs in this action. It actually belongs there. And to withhold it means that you're not giving of yourself completely. I mean, I compare contraceptives to someone who says, you know, you're having a bad hair day. Would you mind putting a paper bag over your head? You know, I want to make love to you, but I can't stand looking at that hair. It's driving me crazy. And that's what a condom is, and that's what a contraceptive is. I love you, but I don't want a very important part of yourself here. Something that actually belongs in this act. Because think of the difference between these two phrases. I want to have sex with you, and I want to have a baby with you. It's awesome, the difference. Again, our society says, I want to have lunch with you, I want to go to movies with you, I want to play tennis with you, I want to have sex with you. No big deal. But if someone comes up to you and says, I want to have a baby with you, you should be knocked off your feet. Okay? Because if they have any idea what they're saying, you know what they're saying. I want to be with you from now to forever. First of all, we'd be bringing forth a new immortal soul, and we have an immortal link through this immortal soul that wouldn't exist if we hadn't engaged in this act. It also means I like your eyes and your smile and the way you walk, and I want to bring another one of you into this world. Right? And I like the way you think, and I want my children to think like you. And I'm willing to be there for midnight feedings and breakfast and PTAs and weddings and a long haul. I don't want to have a baby with you. That's an incredible thing to say to someone. I want to have sex with you. We say that with the greatest of casualness. I want to have babies with you. If you know what you're saying, it's an incredible act. So you have this incredible bond with a person when all of your acts of sexual intercourse leave open the ordination to procreation, whether it's literal or symbolic. At least it's there and preserved in some sense. And that moves me to my last point. You've been patient, but I still have to say some more. And this is this. You all want to wait for this part. You're not ready to move yet. This is the differences between contraception and natural family planning. You know that a lot of people say, what's the difference? You have two couples who don't want to have a baby and want to have sex. And they're doing the same thing. They're trying to have sex without trying to have babies, without wanting to have babies. They're doing the same thing. And that's a very common confusion and a very common complaint. I'm going to try and help you think about it. The first thing I want to say to such couples, such people, is, well, if contraception and natural family planning are the same, why not just use natural family planning? And you know what they say. But that would be completely different. I'd have to change everything. But I said, wait a second, you just told me there's no difference. And now you tell me it would be completely different. But of course what they mean is that there's no moral difference, but they recognize there'd be an enormous lifestyle difference. I said, but wait a second, if there's an enormous lifestyle difference, then that may be a hint that there's some kind of moral difference as well. And first, I try to point out to them the simple principle in ethics that the ends do not justify the means. Stated another way, you must have good means to good ends. Not only your goal must be good, but also the way you get there must be good. So you have a couple who doesn't want a child for probably a very good reason. A couple who's contracepting. A couple who's natural family planning, they can also not want a child at this point for a very good reason. But one uses contraception and one uses natural family planning. Just like two men who both want, or individuals who want to support their family. One robs a bank and one gets a job. You want to say they're both doing the same thing, they're both supporting their family, but they've chosen very different means. And I try to indicate why I think contraception is wrong. It says no to God and His creative act. It says fertility is a bad condition as opposed to a wonderful condition. It puts a wedge between the giving between a husband and a wife. And it has dreadful consequences for society. I want to claim that natural family planning is not open to those same kinds of objections. It does not do those same things. Now, most couples who are frightened about using natural family planning, and frightened is the right word, they are frightened of using natural family planning. And largely for two reasons. One is they think it doesn't work. And I would like to show all of you an article from the British Medical Journal, September 18, 1993, where a doctor reviews the evidence on natural family planning and says it's more effective than the most effective contraceptive. More effective. He cites studies from, of all places, Calcutta. And you know who it is who's teaching natural family planning in Calcutta, this diminutive Catholic nun, all right? And he's found out that most of these are Muslims and Hindus to whom she teaches this. And they have what is called a virtual zero pregnancy rate, 0.004 pregnancy rate, all right? Look it up. But that doesn't seem to convince people, They're thinking of the old rhythm method, some 27% ineffective. And you have to tell them there's a huge difference between the rhythm method and the modern methods of natural family planning. I can give a review course on them in a minute, but I'm talking about the moral business here. The second is they're afraid of the abstinence, right? They think the abstinence will just be too hard. And it's mostly the women who are afraid of it. And they're afraid of it because of the males. They think, my husband will get too irritable. He'll get too grumpy. He'll be removed and distant and won't be affectionate and will stay away from me during that time. And how will we make up our fights? And how will we talk? And I'm nervous about what's going to happen. And men feel greatly deprived. Who can go that long? Who can go 7 to 12 days? It's not right. Right? That's not what I got married for. Right? But my observation is this, that those who have used contraception before marriage and used contraception within marriage, they are very frightened of the abstinence because sex has become key to their relationship. And they think that when you take the sex out of the relationship, where's the love going to be? Where's the intimacy going to be? But couples who have abstained before marriage have little or no problem with natural family planning. Little or no problem. And that's for a very good reason, because they think that abstinence is a way of expressing love. It's not this huge deprivation. Because the reason that they abstained before marriage was not because they weren't attracted to each other, not because they didn't have abundant opportunity, not because they weren't madly in love with each other and the hormones were raging, but because they loved each other. And they said, I'm not going to have sex with you before marriage because I love you. I don't want to hurt you. I don't want to have a stronger commitment than I've made here. I don't want to put us in danger of having a baby when we haven't really prepared for that baby. Marriage is preparation for those bonds. Marriage is preparation for that baby. Right? And I love you. And I can wait. That's how much I love you. Within marriage, abstinence has that same aspect. It's not a good idea for us to have a child right now. We can abstain. We did it before. We know how to show our affection at this time. We know how to be loving to each other at this time because we've done it before. And they can do it. Women who use natural family planning have an amazing sense of self-respect and well-being. Right? They think that their fertility is revered by their husbands, and they think they've got themselves particularly good husbands. I've got my husband who's particularly good. He's a wonderful man. He's got high moral standards. He doesn't treat me like a sex object. I can trust him. Right? He likes me even when we're not having sex together. He's a great guy. I got myself a good one. And males have a great reverence for their wives. This fertility, they don't want to damage her body. They don't want her to take all these pills and use these devices. And they say, no, I love her. I wouldn't put her through those risks. Right? I can. And this woman, willingness to have a baby for me, that's a wonderful thing. What a woman puts herself through. And I am going to respect that. So there's this deep bond between the two of them. And it doesn't say no to God. You see, it respects a woman's fertility, has no bad social consequences, in fact, wonderful ones. There's almost a non-existent divorce rate among couples using natural family planning. It doesn't say no to God because God has said, I want to be there at the fertile time. I made the fertile time for bringing forth new human life. If you engage in this act, I want my option of making new human life. But I gave you a half of a month, three quarters of a month, where you're infertile. You want to pursue the bonding power of sexual act without babies? Do it then. I'm asleep. I'm out of town. Okay? I don't expect to be invited at that time. I'm not around. You can't even do it. Okay? I won't come. I can't. I made your body in a certain way. There's no saying no to God. There's respecting the fertility as if it's a kind of sacred ground. You don't walk there unless you're prepared for the consequences. It's much like dieting. People tell you natural family planning is much like dieting. We have this phenomenon now of bulimia. People eat and they throw up. That's a bit like contraception. You want the pleasure, but you don't want the consequences. You engage in the act and you violate the act. Whereas natural family planning is a lot like dieting, but a lot better. When you diet, you can't eat the chocolate cake, you have carrots and celery. Sex during infertile time apparently is a lot better than carrots and celery. Your options are better. There's a pinch in it. It's difficult, but it's not impossible, and it does great things for marriage. Couples will tell you, they've always told me this, you read this in all the NFP literature, those who use natural family planning communicate better with each other. I've always wondered what that meant. Does it mean people are even having sex or talking, but not both? And because they're not having sex during the fertile time, does that mean they're talking more? There's something to that. You know, I've read somewhere that couples, I'm not married, and of course I'm envious in many respects of the married, especially for companionship, but you read things like people say that there's 27 minutes a week on the average that couples talk to each other. I say, gosh, if that's all it is, maybe it's not worth it, 27 minutes. But anyway, these natural family planning couples must use that 27 minutes well. And they tell me the conversation, I figured this out, what they're talking about. It goes something like this. They have this conversation once a month, maybe 12 times a year. And it happens on that weekend when the mother-in-law takes the children or you have a nice little business trip and you're looking forward to this nice weekend together. Little quiet lunch, maybe some shopping, a movie, a romantic dinner, and then a nice evening of relaxed lovemaking with no children, no stress, just a nice night. And the woman gets up in the morning and she says, darling, I'm afraid I've entered the fertile phase. Right? So there's this deflation, this disappointment. The weekend's not going to be everything we thought it would be. This little conversation ensues, which usually starts with the question, why are we doing this? Right? Why are we abstaining? And sometimes that provokes a conversation about contraception and why or why not, but usually that's settled. And usually the question means, why did we decide it's not a good idea to have a baby? Why are we abstaining? And the husband might say, well, you know, the reason we decided not to have a baby right now is you said you're too tired. You've got too many little ones, or you've got a job now, and you're really fatigued, and you really can't imagine having another child. Are you still tired? Right? And she might say, well, no, as a matter of fact, I'm not too tired right now. Younger one's a little bit older, and you know, I think I might be able to handle another baby. Let's take a risk. Let's really enjoy this day in the way we planned. Or she might say, of course I'm still tired. You never help. Okay, you said you'd give the kids a bath. You don't give them a bath. You said you'd let me have Saturday afternoons free. I've never had a Saturday afternoon free. Of course I'm still tired. And he might say, I'll start bathing them tomorrow, dear. Right? Or he might say, or she might say, the reason we're not having a child right now is you said that your financial burdens are too great. You can't imagine supporting the family we already have, let alone any more. Are you still financially burdened? And he might say, well, no, I'm not. We refinanced the house and I was kind of panicking. I'm getting a promotion. Things are okay. Let's take a risk. Or he might say, of course I'm still financially burdened. Your friend Jane gets a fence around the house. You have to have a fence around the house. Your friend Jane gets a new kitchen. You need a new kitchen. Your friend Jane gets new dishes. You need new dishes, right? And she might say, I don't need those new dishes, right? But the important thing is that they're having this conversation, and it's a conversation that's focused around the most important things, which is why they're having babies and why they are not having babies, and how their life is going together, and are they sharing the burdens or not. And couples using contraception tell me that they can go for a very long time without having that conversation. They can say, we're not going to have babies for another 3 to 5 years, and we'll talk about it then, and that's when they talk about it. And they go apart and move to their jobs and come back for dinner and go to jobs and come back for dinner, and that's about what it is. So I'm saying natural family planning does not have bad social consequences. It's very difficult to use outside of marriage. It does not say no to God and his procreative act. It treasures a woman's fertility, and it enhances, not alienates, the relationship between spouses. It is not subject to the same objections as contraception. Now I'll close with one thing here and give you a chance to ask some questions. But I've taken to giving talks on premarital sex to my students with some frequency, and I've discovered that they are absolutely terrified at the notion of divorce. They hate divorce, right? Because they've either been children of divorced households and have experienced pain and trauma themselves, or they've seen their friends go through it, and they don't want it. When they get married, they want to be married for good, and they're not all convinced it can be, because they've seen so much divorce around them. I have a brother-in-law who was the son of a divorced household. He was very young, and his father left the family. And my parents have been married now for coming up on 50 years. And he follows my father around. Like, my father has this huge curiosity. You know, like, where did this man come from that could be married to the same woman for 50 years, and how did he do it? He can see how happy we all are with this wonderful, intact household, as we now call them. So I make my friends, my students, this offer, and either someday I'm going to be a very poor woman, or I'm going to be hailed as a prophet in my own time. Right? I make them this offer. I say, I will give them $1,000 if they get divorced, if they followed the formula that I tell them. And I really like to tell people what to do, and this is what I tell them to do. I say, first of all, I'm glad you've heard my talk. It's not necessary, but it helps. I said, but these are the four things you need to do if you want to get married and never get divorced. First of all, you can't have sex before marriage. Right? And I say, if you've started, stop. And stop for at least a year and a half to 2 years before you get married and start thinking about sex and what it's all about and why it's a good idea not to have sex before you get married. Secondly, when you get married in a church and go to church every Sunday and pray while you're there, you know. Go to church, get married in church, go to church. Thirdly, use natural family planning and not contracept within marriage. And fourthly, tithe. Give 10% of your money to church or charity. I said, if you get God, sex, and money in the right place, everything else is easy, right? So I promised them this. So I've gone on and on and on, as I promised. I'm only through about the second step in the 12-step program in our non-stop talkers support group. But I would like to say, again, our culture thinks that contraception is one of the greatest things going. Again, I think it's very hard to escape that perspective in the culture in which we live. But when one sees the deeper reality that the church sees, you can begin to see why the church has an explanation for the chaos that has resulted as a result of a contraceptive society, and the rest of the world can't even see the chaos, let alone know what the causal connections are. So I thank you very much, and I'd like to take any questions you might have. Thank you for being so patient.
How is your message received by Catholic clergy?
The Catholic clergy? Oh, man, how am I received by the Catholic clergy? Kind of a sad question. They're my hardest group to talk to. I've received maybe half a dozen to 10 invitations to address Catholic clergy and deacons, and this is at the mandate of their bishop. Now, even in these meetings, a lot of the ones who are really opposed to me don't show up, so I'm already starting out with a fairly sympathetic audience. Again, the statistics on this are hard to come by, and they're variant, but some studies show that only 35% of Catholic priests support the Church's teaching on this. I've seen as high as 47%. I expect it's as low as 35% or lower. I could be cynical. I think there's reasons for that. Again, reasons why they might not be as culpable as we might judge them to be. Before 1968, again, in 1960, as I said, 66% of Catholics were living by the Church's teaching. Priests who were trained before Humanae Vitae were not trained to defend the Church's teaching or explain it. They were simply taught to assert it, and Catholics, for the most part, accepted it. After 1968, very quickly, dissenters got control over most of the seminaries, and most priests taught after 1968 were taught that the Church was going to change its teaching on this someday, and that Catholics, in good conscience, could dissent from the Church if their conscience told them this was all right. That's a whole other question. I mean, how many Catholics have really consulted their conscience on this issue? But let's leave it at that. So I'm speaking to an audience that has been largely for 25 years been actually doing what they were told, telling people that contraception is all right if their consciences tell them so. And I can kind of feel a real hesitancy when I start out, to say the least. In fact, usually the priests who support the church's teaching, I can identify them quite quickly. They're marginalized, and they actually sit on the margin. Okay, I can find them. I often find that about 20 minutes into my talk, I sense this real drop of certain defenses. And this could be entirely subjective on my part, but it's what I experience. And a sort of sense like, all right, there's something here. I better listen to this. And about another 45 minutes into the talk, I get this sense like, whoa, she's really starting to make sense. Maybe I better be nicer to those couples who use natural family planning and give them more support. And that's about as far as I think I get sometimes. I'm confident, much more confident about the upcoming clergy, those under 40 years of age. I found that they are much more likely to be supportive of the church's teaching on this topic, partly because they have seen the consequences of a contraceptive culture. Many of these young men have stood on the picket lines protesting abortion. And you don't have to stand on that line for long to make the connection between contraception and abortion, and then other things start to unfold from that. And a lot of them are much more inclined to think that this Pope has some wisdom and are ready to line up behind him. And he has really made this a major part of his pontificate. So I think there's hope in both respects. I think the older priests, I mean, priests have become priests because they want to lay down their lives and serve others. They're good souls. And they're permitting contraception is not because they want to lead people down the garden path, because they're actually doing what they've been taught for the most part. And I think that I think it's up to the laity to go a long way in helping them see what contraceptives have done to marriages. Thank you for the question.
Is there an impact to the loss of grace for couples who contracept?
Taylor, you discussed the impact of the loss of grace in
That's a very good question. This question is about, is there an impact of a loss of grace on marriages? And I think, obviously, that 50% of marriages are ending in divorce among Catholics as well as the rest of the population suggests that there's an impact of a loss of grace in this. I think that those who contracept, even if they're confident that what they're doing is right, they can't feel quite as enthusiastic about their church as otherwise. They can't be quite racing to be full-fledged members of this church. Many of them are very active in their parishes and love their church, but they've got this sort of, my church teaches something that's wrong. And you can't have that full embrace. You're not confessing this because you don't think it's wrong. You're not getting the healing graces and the empowering graces from confession that you would get. I think couples who use natural family will tell you, natural family planning will tell you, that prayer and the sacraments are at the heart of what they do. They need that help to be faithful to what they believe and to raise the children that they have. And so I think there certainly isn't, it's always hard to measure the impact of grace. I mean, that's an unseen reality. It's there, but to measure it. But I think it can be seen as far as what is happening with marriages. Again, I think if you're around couples who use natural family planning, you really do sense a quite spectacular closeness that they have, and self-respect and mutual admiration that I think is not as often clearly there in couples who contracept. And again, I think couples, most contraceptors are what I would call subjectively innocent. They're doing something that is objectively wrong, but they're not getting up in the morning and saying, I want to perform an offense against God, I want to be hostile to my fertility, and I don't want to give myself to my spouse completely. They're not saying that, but again, their act says that. And I think they are going to be suffering harmful consequences from what they do and kind of be surprised at this. Let me just give you this little anecdote. I have a friend who has 7 brothers and sisters. They were all raised Catholic, and very few of them are practicing Catholics now. And all of them are contraceptors, except one couple. And the couple that is not contracepting have, using natural family planning, have 4 children, all planned, etc. The other couples, again, have no children, all contracepting. 2 income households, you know, lots of disposable income, lots of time for romance and fun. And one night, the 8 of them were having a very open discussion about their sex lives. And all of the women, the contracepting women, were complaining that they felt that they were just being used in the sexual act. Right? They felt that this was just one more thing that was expected of them, and they felt used. And the men were complaining. They were complaining that they had been reduced to begging for sex, which they found demeaning, and that they were engaging in sex with a woman who just wasn't all that engaged. She might just as well be watching TV. And they're having this conversation. The couple using natural family planning were kind of looking at each other quizzically and saying, what are they talking about, right? Is sex not interesting? Is sex not as interesting as TV? begging for sex. I don't know what this is all about. Right? They're doing just fine. Now, if you were to look at these couples, I mean, the contracepting couples, two incomes, fitness clubs, you know, designer clothes, the couple with their four children, getting pudgy, gray, financially stressed, not as much sleep, etc. See, now, which couples are having a satisfying sex life? Right? It's amazing, but it's the opposite of what one would expect. And I think there's something there, again, in natural family planning that causes this kind of closeness and love between a couple that is really the heart and soul of really what makes sex good. It's not having a designer body and designer clothes and lots of disposable income. That won't buy you a good sex life. It's really trust and love and tenderness and really knowing and communicating with the individual with whom you are having sex. And that's what natural family planning brings about. And so in couples, I mean, these contracepting couples, they might suggest to them that contraception is the problem. It would be astonishing for them to think that that might be the problem. But it seems to me, again, there's good reason to think that maybe, in fact, that is what is making things flat in their relationship.
Do you think there should be sex education classes?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the abstinence message is largely... Again, just refrain, largely because of either unpleasant consequences of some sexually transmitted diseases, which, of course, should not be underestimated. I mean, you certainly have the death-dealing AIDS, but you have, I think there's some 35 other strains now of sexually transmitted diseases, which are extremely damaging. I mean, there's apparently this huge increase in the amount of infertility, which is most traceable to these sexually transmitted diseases, because women are having sex with more than one partner, getting these diseases, having scarring in their fallopian tube, etc. All these things, young people should know. They definitely should know all these things. But your notion is that chastity is something different from abstinence. And chastity really is understanding what your sexual powers are for. And in a certain sense, ordering your life in such a way that those sexual powers will be reserved to the time when it's appropriate. And this is something, again, that natural family planning, I think, really helps with. I mean, as you've all noticed, our society is absolutely saturated in sexual stimuli. Absolutely saturated. That it's hard to, you know, go about an hour in the morning without having something assault your senses. You drive to work and you see three billboards with scantily clad individuals. You turn on TV, you see people embraced in some sexual life. I went to Dillard's, which is a department store, the other day to buy a coffee pot. You know, in every single aisle there was a perfume ad with a naked man and woman in this passionate embrace. And I'm thinking, I want to buy a coffee pot, okay? I did not want to see pornography, and here it is, I'm assaulted by this. This is not something, God did not hang these things from trees. You know, this isn't part of his design that we are going to have this kind of assault on our senses. I know friends who get up on Sunday morning and take the lingerie ads out of the newspaper because it's just as bad as Playboy. There's no point in having their 15-year-old boys be assaulted with this, but you can't avoid it, music, etc. And what happens, and this happens more often to the male individual, though it can also happen to the female individual, but I'll do more male bashing, and make it the male. And he's been in office all day long, and this is not his fault. I mean, he's been assaulted by this when he drives to work. He turns on the TV, people tell dirty jokes, there's scantily clad women in the office place. His imagination starts to run. And all day long, he's fantasizing about some woman. He comes home at night, and he's really ready to go. And there's a female in the kitchen, you see, who's quasi-available. And now he has sex with this woman. He doesn't make love to this woman. He has sex with this woman. He's fantasizing about some other woman. Hasn't thought about his wife all day long. And natural family planning puts a kind of a stop to that. Because you see, you're going to have to abstain some 7 to 12 days a month. And you can't come home like that. So you've got to start shutting these things out. You've got to say, I don't want to listen to that. I don't want to see this. I don't want to look at this magazine. I don't want to watch this movie. Because it fills me with thoughts that I'm not going to be able to act upon. And they're not fair to my wife anyway. I've started to appreciate this complex woman that I'm dealing with. And when I make love, I want to make love to her. And John Paul II says that natural family planning brings about what he calls the virtue of self-mastery, which is the same as the virtue of chastity. And he says it actually makes people better lovers. Because now they're making love to the person they love rather than to some fantasy. And instead of satisfying some sexual urge, they can control those sexual urges, and now they're acting again upon a love impulse and not a sex impulse. And I think that's what young people have to learn, is that they are virtually assaulted by their culture. Not to mention, I think young people need to learn about original sin, and that all of us have disordered appetites in almost every angle of our life. We want to eat more, sleep more, drink more, and have more sex than is good for us, in ways with people, etc., that aren't good. And that's a result of our fallen nature. We can expect this, so we shouldn't sort of be startled and astonished and upset that these things are happening to us. It's part of the course of things. But we have to learn to reorder ourselves. And I think young people need to say, yeah, this is going to happen to you. A lot of it's not your fault. It's the fault of your culture. The other problem is you're a human being. But you have to work at this, and the rewards are great. Again, the couples I've known who have gotten married and have been chased before marriage have this kind of innocence and euphoria in marriage, which is absolutely enviable. You know, this notion, this real trusting of each other, and this real sense that sex is clean and not dirty. That's one thing that happens with premarital sex, is people often get to think of sex as being something dirty. It's something naughty. It's something you sneak around and do. Whereas couples who wait until they get married, for them, sex is good. It's clean. It's pure. It's something I saved for this person. So all of that young people don't know what they're missing out on when they're letting culture just sweep them along. I mean, I think the young people have just not been led by adults. They've been led by adults down the garden path. And we need to, you know, we've gone down some of those garden paths, some of those dead ends, and we need to warn them. It's not any good. We tried that. Don't you try it. You'll see. And I think that's, chastity is very different from the simple abstinence message. And again, our culture doesn't know how to teach abstinence because every single moment of the day it works against abstinence. I mean, chastity. Wow, those seats are probably getting pretty hard. Whoops. You're the most hated man in the house right now. Go ahead.
How can we evangelize friends and family with this information?
I think I'm going to count on you to do that. You sound like you're very capable of doing that. It's very hard to evangelize, especially one's own friends and family. But a good way of doing it is to start giving them tapes and document. Listen to this, read this, instead of talking yourself. And say, after you've read this and listened to this, let's talk. I think that's the first step. It's just opening up a line of communication with a lot of people about this. Because, as I said, very few people have reflected on this, and understandably so, because nothing provokes them to reflect upon it. Few Catholics have ever read any encyclical, let alone Humanae Vitae. We are the most literate society in the history of mankind. But we read Newsweek and Consumer's Report and People magazine, and never a church encyclical. Well, this is a good one to start with. And Familiaris Consortio is great. They're all great. Once you get started, you start to learn how to wade through them. And they're wonderful. So I would start with that. Study groups. You have friends, and especially young people. Let's meet once every other week and go through Familiaris Consortio together. Get together and read it page by page. Don't make people read it ahead of time. Get together, read two pages, and talk about it. Married couples do the same thing. Invite some of your friends in and say, let's read this together. And you'll be amazed at what emerges from sessions like that. That's only one small suggestion, but I'm sure seminarians like you are going to make a difference for us. Thank you all very much.